Have you been listening to the podcast and getting value from the show? If so, I've got a small favor to ask, because over the next few months, we're going to be making some changes to better serve you. Now, I could keep creating episodes based on what I think would be most helpful, but I would much rather get this right. So instead of guessing, I want to understand where you are right now and the real challenges you, your organization, and your team are facing. That's why I've put together a very short 90-second survey. It'll help me better understand you and how I can serve you at a much higher level. And as a thank you, the first 30 people who complete it will receive a free signed copy of one of our books. To take part, just go to the show notes and click the link titled Leadership Survey. Or you can go directly to letsgrowleaders.com/podsurvey. PODSURVEY. It'll take less than 2 minutes. I really appreciate your input. It will genuinely help shape the future of the show.
Marketing is one of the places where so much harm has been done in our culture, thus through accidentally bad and intentionally toxic marketing, you know, manipulative marketing. And there's a whole history there that I could go into from the origins of Madison Avenue and all of that.
Hey, it's David, and you're listening to Leadership Without Losing Your Soul, your source for practical leadership inspiration, tools, and strategies you can use to achieve transformational results without sacrificing your humanity or your mind in the process.
All right, welcome to the show today on Leadership Without Losing Your Soul. You're here in the right place for a podcast helping human-centered leaders master communication to accelerate your team's performance, reduce stress, and build a career with the respect and influence you deserve. I'm your host, David Dye, president of Let's Grow Leaders, and I am very excited to introduce you to our guest today, because in this episode, you are going to get tools that are going to help you heal from toxic business cultures so you can thrive in your work. We're going to talk about cultivating 5 qualities your heart needs so your business can succeed, how to build human-centered, effective marketing, and then the consequent sales after that, and then embracing 4 different kinds of work you do and how to integrate those for a more peaceful work life. And our expert and our guest today to help us do all those things, his name is Mark Silver, and he's the author of a book called Heart-Centered Business, Healing from a Toxic Business Culture So Your Small Business Can Thrive. Now, don't leave us yet, you may be in a big business, all the principles still apply, so we'll get into it. But Mark's a fourth-generation entrepreneur who has run a distribution business, turned around a struggling nonprofit magazine, worked as a paramedic in the San Francisco Bay Area, and founded Heart of Business in 2001. He's a designated master teacher, and I'm gonna have to ask you to pronounce this, Mark, within the...
It's a Sufi lineage. It's a spiritual lineage in Sufism.
But give us the word. Give us the word.
Shadaliya.
I can say that once I know
how. Yes.
So designated master teacher within the Shadaliya Sufi lineage and has received his Master's of Divinity with a specialty in ministry and Sufi studies. Coach, consultant, mentor, spiritual healer, has worked with over 4,000 businesses since 1999, facilitating thousands of individual sessions with entrepreneurs, leading hundreds of classes, seminars, group retreats. I am so glad that you have taken time, Mark, with all of that going on, to be here with us on Leadership Without Losing Your Soul. Thank you for being a guest today.
Well, I'm just delighted. Thank you so much, David. I really appreciate it.
Well, and I appreciate it too. So I have to share with our listeners. So the way I got connected with Mark, we have a mutual acquaintance, Pam Slim, down in Arizona. And Pam is an expert on if you are looking at marketing and you do run a small business or things like that. She is so good at that. And I came across Mark's book on her desk because, Mark, you had been a client, I think, just a little while previously to when we were down there. And Heart-Centered Business was there. And I said, I have got to get that book because we're all about heart-centered, human-centered leadership here. And so then I read the book and said, okay, I got to get Mark, asked for an introduction. Pam kindly introduced you, and here we are.
So, well, I'm delighted. Pam, I've known Pam for years and years and years. She's been to our home. She met our kids, you know, and although I haven't traveled out to Arizona, but it's, she's a special person. Her heart is so big and her expertise is so grounded. I just have huge respect for her. So
As do we. Big fan. So there you go. Pam, if you're listening, I don't know if you are, but we might have to send you this one. Shout out for Pam Slim and the work you do. All right. So Mark, to get to know you just a little bit better, I ask every guest, and I have to ask you to take us back, and you can go back as far as you want, to your earliest memory of yourself as a leader, one of your earliest leadership memories, whatever that might be.
It's really interesting because when I was young, when I was a kid, I was just having this conversation with someone recently. It's like, I never wanted the number one slot. Like as kids, we would play Star Trek in the backyard. And I always wanted to be Spock, never Captain Kirk, you know? Later on, when I became, when I got involved in theater in college a bit, I wanted to do the backstage work. I didn't want to be the director. I didn't want to be on the stage. I wanted to kind of like, you know, be backstage like that. And I think that, you know, when there was a very distinct moment in leadership that happened when I first became a paramedic in my early 20s. I got my paramedic training after getting out of college. I'm like, what am I going to do? I don't want to go to grad school. And I'd been a volunteer EMT before that. And then I got hired. I was working in Vallejo, California, because we were living in the Bay Area at the time. And we got on scene of one of my very first calls on my own. And I was the only paramedic on scene. Everybody else had less training on me. And I remember walking into the room and the patient looks at me. The patient's family looks at me. The fire department was already there, turned and looked at me. And then my partner looked at me. And I was very tempted to look behind me. I'm like, is there somebody else here? And there wasn't. I was it in that moment. And that was a pivotal moment for me. Like that kind of like, and I don't honestly remember the details of what happened after that. But what I do remember is there was some way that I was like, okay, I've got to meet this challenge. Like, you know, I've been prepared and I'm a rookie, but I'm here. They said I can do it. I guess I can do it. So I stepped in. And when I think of myself over time in that particular job, the difference between myself as a rookie and when I eventually left the job 8 years later, and the sense of kind of embodied leadership and authority that I had was miles. And I remember taking the time to reflect, having some help reflecting on that journey of what I, you know, the term sovereignty is the one that I use a lot now. But the sense of sovereignty both in myself that enabled me to feel like I had the ability to call other people in to help do what I saw needed to be done. Mm. And to ask people or direct people in whatever I was seeing in that time. Now, first, being a leader in a very top-down hierarchical position, like being a first responder, is different than kind of a team-based approach in an organization, especially because there's no emergencies going on. It might feel like it, but there's not a real emergency. And so it's different, but like that was very much kind of a coming of age into like, yeah, I can hold the room. I can hold the project. I can hold what needs to be done. And people are willing to kind of lean in and I can call in support like that. So that was a big one for me. A
couple of beautiful elements there. One, I also chose to play Spock when we were playing Star Trek in the backyard. So we do have that in common. But yeah, I was never a Kirk guy. I'm more of a Picard guy, if we're going to be honest. The thing that you're drawing out, like there was that moment where everybody looked at you. It wasn't, you hadn't asked for it, but there it was. And you chose to step through that door and to take that responsibility that everybody had looked at you for. But then there's that element that you were just, as you were wrapping up, and you call attention to this in the book as you get into some of the five qualities that your heart needs for your business to succeed. The first one that you talk about is vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And part of your definition of vulnerability that I recall from reading is the ability to ask for help. Like, you can't do this on your own. I'm asking you to come be a part of this. And I mean, I've heard, you know, we talk a lot about vulnerability and transparency on this show. There's lots of different angles, but I don't think I've ever heard it described quite that way. Mm-hmm. And so even one of your earliest leadership memories, you're talking about stepping into that ability, and there's a vulnerability there, even in a hierarchical top-down, like, you got to invite people into that solution.
It's so true. You know, vulnerability was such a, it was not something that I approached easily. I think a lot of people raised as men in this culture, it's like vulnerability is not something we're invited into, you know, or asked, you know, or it's not something that we're expected or safe to develop. And yet I was never, like, I wasn't a big sports person. I was never popular. I was never, you know, I was, it didn't get hammered into me quite as much as if I'd been on the football team or something, I suppose. But, you know, vulnerability, it's like, I think many, you know, we've all hit those moments in life where we can't force our way through. We can't stiff arm our way through. We can't bluster our way through, or if we do, it's going to be disastrous. And this really came home to me on my spiritual path. Just the emphasis on surrender, this emphasis on how vulnerable we all are all the time and how much we have very legitimate needs. You know, at the very basic level, you know, it's very humbling to realize, like, you know, and this comes from the medical training as well as the spiritual path. It's like, you got to breathe. If you're not taking a breath every 10 to 12 seconds, you know, it's not going to take very long before you're no longer here. And so dependent on the whole world around me, on the trees to create oxygen, you know, and to the plants and everything to support me and the need for food. You know, our boys, we have twin teen boys, and they were preemies, you know, and they were in isolettes the first few weeks. And learning about the need for skin-to-skin contact, the need we have for each other, and how our physical growth can be stunted at a young age without that. And to really embrace, to really face, like, oh yeah, like, vulnerability is the only way that anything gets in. Like, if we're, like, being invulnerable, the definition of invulnerable is nothing can get in. And if we're wanting more, if we want to accomplish things, if we want our organizations, our businesses to do well, if we're wanting to you know, achieve more, do more, that's letting things in. And that requires a surprising amount of vulnerability. And I think it's kind of like the keystone quality. I think without vulnerability, nothing else happens. And it's challenging because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. I'm curious, Mark, as you do your work with leaders and you're trying to help them cultivate vulnerability, and, you know, somebody's listening right now going, okay, yeah, I hear what you're saying conceptually, I get it, but how do I do vulnerability practically? I mean, we talked about asking for help. There's the things you can't do. So let's invite that help in, or inviting your team in, or recognizing those. But what are some other ways that you encourage leaders to cultivate or practice vulnerability?
Yeah, well, it's a really good question. I think there are some practical things, and there's some inner pieces that I think are helpful. The inner pieces are some of what I've already touched on, is just like taking the time to become aware of how much we're dependent, even at what might seem like absurd levels, but they're real. Like, right now I'm on the third floor in my home office. I'm really dependent on the competency of the people who built this house that I'm not falling 30 feet to my, you know, it's like there's so many moments like that, that if we just take a moment in different contexts to just notice and appreciate how much we're dependent on other people and how vulnerable that makes us. Vulnerable that cars choose to stop at a red light. Vulnerable that, you know, that people decide that they want to continue farming, and so there's food for me to access. So it can sound silly in certain contexts, but when the more we meditate on that, the more the gratitude can arise and the more the vulnerability is. Now, in terms of practical practices, one simple thing I ask people to do is to start to ask for help in like low stakes moments, because you know we're practicing, at times when you don't need it. You know, a lot of times a lot of these skills and a lot of these qualities that we want to develop, we are often forced to develop them when we're up against a wall. You know, it's like you hear about people who are like suddenly facing an illness, you know, like cancer or something. And so they're suddenly on their knees and they're suddenly like willing to accept help, or you're in a really disastrous situation in your business and you're like, I cannot do this. And you start reaching out for help. But we can start to practice just like, oh, hey, do you mind handing me that thing over there, even though I could have gotten up and gone and gotten it? Or, hey, can you get the door for me? Or, hey, do you mind making this phone call for me? And you know, those of us that have team or have, you know, may have had practiced it to a certain level, but a lot of us are still carrying the idea that we need to do it ourselves and we should only ask under absolute need. Now, let me bring in a little nuance here. There's a difference between being like a tyrant and just telling people, yeah, get me coffee because I want it. Like, you know, I mean, I'm hoping that people can taste the difference that I'm trying to get at here. It's not about ordering people around. It's about being vulnerable. Like, oh, you know, I can't do it all myself. Are you willing to help me with this? You know, are you willing to help me with this? I would really love some help with this. And it can, people are, it's a simple practice, but it's surprising what it brings up for folks, because so often, I mean, I have a small team. We have a tiny business, but we have a small team, and I have frank conversations with them, and I have in the past, about how I don't want to burden them with requests, even though it's their job, you know. And
I think leaders struggle with that very dynamic. I know I have.
It's wild. It's wild. And by making myself vulnerable, even admitting that, oh, you know what? I'm a little shy to ask you to do these things. I'm counting on you to tell me if you're at capacity or if your priorities are getting thrown or whatever. And so I'm going to practice asking more of you. And I just, you know, I want you to know I'm sincere. You tell me if you can't handle it, or if your plate's getting full and you need me, need my help as your boss. Yeah. To reset your priorities. And so that's a practice that I think can be life-changing if you come at it from this place of cultivating vulnerability.
You know, those two elements that you just talked about, and I have done both of these. The second one, the asking for help when you don't necessarily need it, in order to cultivate that, it is incredibly powerful. And then going back to the first thing that you said about meditating on that vulnerability, and one of the aspects of that that I think is so powerful for a leader is the dependency you have on your team. You know, we so often think about leadership and I'm in power over this team or this department or this organization. And actually, that's not how it works. We are dependent on them for things to happen. And you used a word that I just think is as, and this is practical to really contemplate this and get it into our bones, that realization that nobody has to do anything, that they are choosing to every day. And the gratitude that we can approach our work, our leadership, our teams, our organizations with is transformational. It really changes how you lead when you really get that into your psyche, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And it's really, I mean, I'm so grateful for my team, you know, and that they choose to stick around and not go off and do something else, which they could do. And it's that sense of mutuality. And we have to be careful, I think, as leaders, because I think that a dynamic that can quickly become toxic is when leaders attempt to talk about a business like it's a family, or like we're all equals here, or like we're all, you know, it's like, oh, you know, this is all, you know, no, the it's truth not. it's not like I'm the owner of the business. My wife and I are the owner of the business. I, you know, give you your paycheck, you know, I have decision-making ability about whether you stay in the position or not. And it's, I don't want to say too far down the road of vulnerability, because I don't think you can do that. But I think that we can, in exploring vulnerability, lose sight of the power that we carry. And when that power isn't acknowledged and spoken to, you know, and isn't acknowledged, it goes underground. And that's, things can get twisted, because people, you know, this is where a lot of lack of trust arises in a workplace, because workers know very well, you know, team knows very well the power that the leader holds.
Or and, I have also seen it where that leader who really uses that language, oh, we're a family and so forth, and maybe out of a good intention, but some naivete, creates expectations in the workforce that they can't possibly honor, because you're not a family.
You're not a family.
Family and it's not a different dynamic.
And it's a, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's an exactly. important distinction. We're talking with Mark Silver. The book is Heart-Centered Business, Healing from a Toxic Business Culture So Your Small Business Can Thrive. And Mark identifies 5 qualities that your heart needs so your business can succeed. And we have just been camped out on the first one here for half the show already, vulnerability, because it's so critical. The other 4 are creativity, trust, sovereignty, and patience. And Mark, I'm wondering if you would choose one of those for us and unpack it just a little bit. It might be hard, creativity, trust, sovereignty, or patience, as another of these characteristics that we can be cultivating that are critical to our business and our success.
Yeah, I know. You can't see, they form an ecosystem together, right? Exactly. And so in choosing one to explore, not elevating it, I did say vulnerability is the keystone one, because it allows us access to the others, but none of the others to me have any particular importance over. I will speak, you know, what's on my heart today is patience. It's come up a lot. So one of the things that I like to talk about, patience has, the way a lot of people talk about patience is it can have kind of a collapsed quality to it. Like, oh, I just have to sit and wait for things to come to me. And if they don't, oh, well, I'll just keep being patient.
So it feels very passive that way.
It's very passive. And, you know, as a Sufi Muslim, you know, when I think about the divine quality of sabur, which is the quality of patience, that's not how it's talked about. It's much more of persistence in the face of adversity or something that doesn't eventuate immediately. As leaders in organizations, I think one of the things that we get used to is that very few of our projects fruit very quickly. You know, it's like there's often, for a lot of things, like a long timeline to them. And there is an increasing pressure in our economy because of a lot, because of the uncertainty in life, uncertainty in economy, uncertainty in world events, for some kind of a surety, some kind of, okay, this is definitely going to happen. And that can force us in a reactive mode to try to hurry things along. And I'm not saying things never happen quickly. Obviously, sometimes things happen quickly. But if we can cultivate a patience, a persistence, and a patience in our heart, we can then embrace the natural timing in things. I lean into the natural world a lot as metaphors. We live on 15 acres here, and we're trying to develop a food forest. We've been planting fruit and nut trees. And, you know, this past year harvest, it was the second year one of our peach trees gave peaches, and they gave a lot of peaches. But the year previously, they just gave a few peaches. And the year before that, there were no peaches. It takes persistence. It takes discernment to know, okay, is this the right timing? And there's something that needs to be unblocked because we should be seeing results now. Or is this a situation that, you know, regardless of how anybody's reacting, regardless of what anybody's saying, the tree just isn't there yet. It's just not there yet. And no matter what we do, we're not really going to get fruit. And if we try to push it, the fruit's going to be gross. It's not going to be what we want. And there is so much good that comes from slowing down. And I think in our culture in particular, because things have been sped up so much, that there is a particular gift and reward that comes from slowing things down to the organic timing that's a part of something's development, and to be able to support ourselves and our team in knowing that, yeah, we wish it would happen faster. Yeah, it's frustrating that this thing isn't happening yet and that we can't get there, but to have the persistence and the patience and the care to follow it through and to not either abandon it too quickly or try to push it too quickly.
I love the natural metaphors myself. I'm here in the mountains of Colorado right now, and the aspens are changing colors and the change of seasons. You can't rush that. It happens when it happens, and you got a couple of weeks if that's the time. And I remember when I was a kid, my dad had some roses and flowers and things. And I remember one morning before I went to school, I really wanted to help, it was late spring, and I really wanted to help one of these roses to bloom a little bit faster. Well, that obviously doesn't work, and I destroyed the darn thing, and it was such a shame. But there is that element, and what is possible when we're in rhythm with those things and with our team and with our customers, incredible results when we can tap into that, which is a really great segue into, it seems like as I went through the book, Mark, I don't know, half or more seems to talk about marketing. And for small businesses, there are different cycles of your marketing journey. And I encourage you, if you're a small business owner, you absolutely want to get this book and you want to explore all that in depth, because there's different kinds of marketing at different stages of your business. But you spend a lot of time on marketing in terms of our relationship to it, in terms of our relationship to our customers, in terms of what a heart-centered marketing approach is. So I know that this is an area of passion. I found it very enlightening and peaceful, ultimately, I think, to explore marketing through the lens that you do. So I'd love if you could talk a little bit and walk us through your approach to marketing, and why you look at it the way you do. And it gets back to this whole cycle of nature and rhythms, and but now our customers.
Right. Yeah, thank you. I'm glad it was so moving to you, because marketing is one of the places where so much harm has been done in our culture, through accidentally bad and intentionally toxic marketing, manipulative marketing. And there's a whole history there that I could go into, from the origins of Madison Avenue and all of that. There's reasons the way it is. But You know, we spend a lot of time on marketing since we're working with small businesses, marketing is a major. It's just like, okay, we need clients, you know. It's like it's a major piece of what happens. And for me, marketing is this, like, how do we cultivate relationships with people that come from a place of caring, that come from a place of empathy, that come from a place of reality? I was just having a conversation with a colleague of mine. We haven't talked in a while, but we've known each other for years and years. And we, you know, his business in particular is tremendous business, Sunset Labs, in Victoria, British Columbia. And they do they do this amazing streaming. They can do remote streaming. They can, anyway, they do very, very sophisticated online streaming presentations for large, or you know, for large organizations and, you know, big events. And he has something that the right people really want. He doesn't really have to sell. Like, when somebody needs his services, they show up. So much marketing, I think, arises from this place that the business owner or the marketer is thinking, oh, I have to convince people to buy from me. And when we're coming at it from that place, it's so gross. It's just gross. I mean, I don't know any other way to talk about it. You know, if we're trying to convince someone that they need to buy what we're selling, something's wrong. It may be that we're not, you know, maybe we don't have a good product or service. That's not often it. You know, people of good heart, you know, are usually trying to put something good in the world. We're maybe not being clear about who we're trying to reach. We're trying to reach the wrong people. But a lot of times what it is coming from a place of trying to speed up the purchasing process in ways that, you know, we were just talking about patience, in ways that don't honor people's sovereignty, that don't honor, you know, the fact that our clients are adults. They can make decisions for themselves. They know what they need. They know what they don't need. They know what their timing is. My job as a marketer, the job of marketing, is not attraction. It's not to pull people in. It's not to convince them. It's not to force an action. It's to create enough safety. It's the job of marketing. The way I see it, is to create safety so that someone can take a breath and slow down and make a decision for themselves about whether your offer is relevant to them and whether the timing is right. Now, there's a lot that goes into that. It's a very broad statement, you know, and there's a lot of details that go into this. And I can go into what I talk about in terms of the three journeys of marketing. But I want to, if people marketing were coming at a place of like, oh, I'm wanting to create safety for people, rather than I'm trying to convince or force people, I think that that would immediately change the experience that people have of our marketing and just moving around in the world. It's so terrible to be bombarded by messages constantly trying to force me or push me to do something. And yeah. I mean, there's a lot of directions I could go in that, but I'll pause there.
There is. Well, I'd like to just explore that notion of safety just a little bit more. So when you're talking about marketing being ultimately, through the lens you're looking at it, an opportunity to create safety, to help somebody have the space to consider what they need and if this is a good match for that and so forth. What does that look like if we're talking about that sort of marketing?
Yeah. So... people want to be seen. People want to be seen. They want to be witnessed. They want to be seen both as whole people. People don't like to be seen as broken. But they also, at the same time, want to be seen if they're struggling with something or if there's something's not working. where traditional marketing, I think, gets it wrong and makes it toxic is that they talk about the problem as if the person is broken, and if they don't get it fixed, they're doomed. And this is an actual traumatic triggering. Like, we're talking about actual trauma. It's like it's a traumatic triggering that causes people to get activated in their nervous systems, and the way to soothe it is to purchase. That's the way a lot of consumer marketing is done. And to be frank, it's the way a lot of organizational selling is done. Like, your organization's screwed if you don't get this thing or buy this service or do this thing. And that activation is not healthy. It's not healthy for anybody. And it's a way sometimes to get quicker sales, but it's also a way to trigger a lot of buyer's remorse and to have a lot of people unhappy with the purchase. There is a difference. I'll use an example from a small business, like from a chiropractor, let's say, between saying, like, oh my goodness, your back is out, and if you don't get it fixed, you'll never be able to pick up your child again, and you won't be able to live an active life, and your life will be misery, you know, so you better come in and get help. You know, it's like you can feel like the kind of, you know, it's a little bit exaggerated, but it's like you can feel that kind of activation.
Not by much.
It feels terrible even to say it. Like, for me to feel it, like, I feel gross even saying it. But to say something like, you know, it's quite normal. People hurt their backs, and it's really hard when you can't do the things that you normally do, and your back can heal. Like, for most people, they can heal their back. There's a lot of ways to do it, and it's something that I love to do. I love to help people get back to their active lifestyles, and to do the things that they care about. They're like the difference in tone. It's like it's almost the same thing, but you can feel the qualitative difference. And the second one comes from a place of respect. It comes from a place of love. It comes from a place of caring. It's very personal to me because I was at my chiropractor this morning. It was probably why it's type of top of mind. But it's like I would love to see the world full of marketing that is just as effective, if not more effective. It might work slightly more slowly, because you're actually giving people time to make a decision in their own timing instead of being forced by reactivity. But it's just as effective in the long term, in the medium term. And it fills the world with a sense of caring and respect and safety that I think we're just better off as a society if we're surrounded with those kinds of messages.
Yeah, big difference between the fear-based and the respectful, supportive approach.
Yeah.
You know, and as you're talking about this, you're thinking of customer-centered, external customer-centered marketing. There's also the kind of marketing we do internally in larger organizations and in our conversations with one another, and how we're, you know, selling in quotes, but selling our services internally. And you know, you may be the only provider if you're in the human resource department of a larger organization, or L&D or IT. It doesn't matter where what you're doing. You've got services that people need. How are you representing those? How are you approaching your colleagues with your services and the opportunities? And is it fear-based or is it respect and support-based?
Right.
It's another opportunity there.
Exactly. Exactly. You know. Yeah, I mean, just in general, I think we're all better off when we approach each other trusting that the other person is an adult that can make their own choices, and that what I'm offering is something that is meant to be helpful and supportive. There's an interesting in the language. So when I started to teach our course, Sacred Selling, about, you know, jumping from marketing to sales, the word to sell comes from an old English word, selgen, which means literally to give voluntarily in response to a request. So if I were to say, hey, David, I see that book back there. Can I can I take a look at that? And then you were to hand it to me. That is literally the origin of the word sell. You just sold me that book. And that's what I think we're aiming for ultimately, to see marketing and selling to be the kind of like the seamless flow of care for one another, you know, where we're meeting each other's needs.
And that gets it so far away from all of the slimy, gross, all the kind of things that we so often automatically associate with the word sales. Yeah, for sure.
And I just want to say that we've worked with 4,500 businesses since 1999. And I mean, people sometimes feel very skeptical when I'm talking like this. And I just want to say that we have so many case studies, including our own business, but lots of case studies where it works because human beings like to be cared for and respected, and they respond better. And the, you know, our specialty as a business, we're not the people to come to if you're like, oh my God, I need to go 10x in the next 6 months. Like, that's not what we do. We don't do that. There are people out there who do that, I guess. We've had people come to us after they've been to people like that, and they're burnt, and they're like, what we do is we like to help businesses create organic, predictable, focused growth so that their revenue can become predictable, so that their income can become predictable, so that they can depend on their business. And at the same time, their business is growing in a way that their heart can be at rest, that they can be proud of what they're doing. And the kind of marketing I'm talking about is not necessarily going to 10X you in 6 months. Although there are a lot of businesses that have been doing it wrong, and some tweaking can get some quicker results sometimes. But what it will do is it will build long-term solidity in the business, where
you're building relationships as opposed
exactly.
to just a transaction.
Exactly. And that way people will trust you and come back to you and refer people to you. You know, so much of our business is based on referrals or goodwill recommendations, because we're not out there burning bridges or harming people.
Exactly. Well, and that is, as we've been unpacking and walking through marketing and then sales, and a common theme in all of this is time, is that there is a natural cycle to it that you can't, well, you can, but it comes at a cost and it's destructive. Force that time frame. And building relationships, any relationship, it takes some time to establish trust and for that person to make a decision. And that's true for all of us too, as well as any of the customers that we're dealing with internally or externally. So our guest today is Mark Silver. His book is Heart-Centered Business, Healing from a Toxic Business Culture, So Your Small Business, and I'm going to extend Any Business, Can Thrive. And Mark, I want to, in a moment, I'm going to ask you to take us into these four different kinds of work. And the you mentioned earlier that ultimately what, you know, is available for people is a heart that is calm and at peace in the midst of their work. And I think that this aspect of these four different kinds of work that we do and integrating those is critical of that. But before we do that, I want to make sure that somebody listening wants to connect with you, find out more about what you do. Where would you send us? Where should we go to learn more?
So the home for our business on the interwebs, heartofbusiness.com. You can go there. You can get on our email list. You can download the first chapter of our book. You can take a free assessment that assesses, it's aimed mainly at small businesses, but it assesses like where you are in the four stages of development. And I really recommend that people take their time and get to know us and make sure that there's a real alignment. I mean, sometimes people are ready and they jump in quickly, but a lot of times people take their time and, you know, it's like, get to know us. And I spent a lot of time bringing this book to life, and You can get it anywhere where, yep, there we are, wherever books are, you can get it. And I just, see if this resonates with you. And check us out. We're happy to hear from folks.
You know, so many, and we are certainly an organization like that, but, and you are too, there's the content marketing, and when it's done well, what that represents. It's that opportunity that we give one another to get familiar and get comfortable and do the consideration, go, yeah, I want more of this. Mm-hmm. And, you definitely do a good job at that. And it's something I know you encourage others to do, and if it's the right for their business. All right. So Mark, I'd like you to take us through those four different kinds of work that we talk about. And the first one is the kind we all think about right away, like productivity. I got to get something accomplished here. And which it is one of the four, but it's not the only one. And I know I can get sucked into that vortex of, well, that's the only one that matters, but there are more and they're important. So let's talk about those.
Yeah. Wait, tell me, I'm so curious, like how they struck you. I'm like, were there any that were surprising, or did they all seem familiar?
All made total sense. The epiphany for me is, and I'm doing this without spoiling what they are for the listener. The epiphany for me is to truly recognize them as valuable work and not minimize the importance of some of these. When I have one of the day where I'm focused more on some of those other elements and I haven't necessarily done the thing that produces a widget or an article or a podcast or a program that I'm delivering or what have you, but there are other kinds of necessary work that are vital, and I need to have those integrated in my mind and in my heart if I'm going to be at peace in the work I'm doing. That for me really was the important part of it.
It's beautiful. I really appreciate you sharing that, because, you know, it's my insight arose around this because in the very beginning of my work, and it's been consistent ever since, is that I was having clients, you know, okay, so what are you going to get done this next week? Kind of like average accountability stuff. And really consistently, people were getting half or less done that was on their list. And part of it is that, you know, our eyes are bigger than our stomach. Like, we don't have a good idea of what our capacity is. But another piece of this is that people aren't really accounting for what it really takes. We're only thinking of like, okay, the productivity part of it, like the actual getting things done. And so one of the other types of work that I think is really important has to do with learning, with a learning project. You know, there a lot of times we're, especially in a changing business landscape, which has become such a cliche, but it's true. Things are
pretty much everybody
change, right? Everything's changing. We're constantly taking on new things. And also to change our business or to develop our business, we're taking on new things. Cause if we were already doing it, you know, we'd already, you know, it's like, oh, this is a new thing. It's not just more of the same. It's something new. And it is impossible to be really good at something that you're new at. It just is. And we come, you know, like often when we're doing something that we're used to a certain competency with it. And it feels weird to be back in the beginner's mind and like, oh my goodness, I'm doing something. Whether it's a new application, new software application, or just a new business flow or new new system, or just a whatever it is, like there's a new way of doing marketing, a new team member. Taking the time, like giving us, like assigning time and space for the learning of it is both just smart, but it's also something that brings a tremendous amount of, I think, compassion to our process. You know, I have clients all the time who come to me and they say, you know what, I'm taking on this new thing. I'm like, okay, so when are you going to learn about it? Like, how are you going to give yourself, like, what kind of time and space are you going to give to learn about it? Are you going to like set aside sometimes several hours or a half a day or a couple of weeks? You know, can you give yourself time to just play around on an application or play around with a workflow without actually having the expectation that anything productive is going to happen. This is something that takes up a significant amount of time, and we're being unrealistic and unfair if we think, okay, here's something brand new. I've got to be productive from the get-go. And I think it actually slows it down, slows down the process, because instead of being in a learning mode, we're trying to get things done. And it increases the likelihood of mistakes, because instead of playing around with something in a way that doesn't really matter to the business, we're working on something real and potentially messing it up. And especially if other people are involved, potentially wasting a lot of time. So I just, it's slowing down to go faster.
And that principle is, I love it's one of these things that I look back over my life and career, and there have been times I do that really well. And then there's other times where I'm like, oh, I forgot about, I need my learning in there and right. And space for it. And that act of playing around with whatever it is that we're learning. And you were highlighting it for us as a leader, that we need to do that for ourselves and give ourselves that space. And then there's the element of our teams and our people. When we're implementing a new anything, where's the playing around time? You know,
right? And are we giving them that? We had someone in a core in a key administrative role that retired, moved on, spent time with her grandkids. Didn't, you know? I was like, yay, boo, come back. Oh well,
exactly.
That happens. And so we hired somebody new. And something that we do when we hire somebody new is, you know, obviously they have time to come up to speed, but I wait. I wait to watch for the first mistake they're going to make, because they're going to make one. And when they do, we celebrate it. We say, yes, you made a mistake. Like, I sent her a whole letter celebrating the mistake, you know, congratulating her on making a mistake, saying that we really appreciated it, because it means that she was willing to try something that she didn't know how to do. She was willing to get in there and do it. And I want people to have a sense, I want people to feel more free to learn rather than coming at it from like trying to minimize mistakes. Of course, we don't want to make mistakes, but it's like the attitude of minimizing mistakes is very different than the attitude of being effective and creative and proactive. It's just they're not the same quality of presence. And I think it's very related to this. It's like, you know, if you need time to play around with something or figure something out, you know, go for it. So important. It's so important.
That emphasizing that principle of celebrating risk-taking, healthy risk-taking, and the making of mistakes. And if we're going to take risks, we're going to learn, they're going to be there. So yeah, absolutely emphasizing that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not a big fan of using, softer language. You know, people say, oh, there's no such thing as a failure or a mistake. It's a learning opportunity. Or it's like, you know, I think that we should really embrace the idea that there are failures and there are mistakes, and that it's okay. That it's okay. There are very clearly mistakes that we can make, you know, and there are very clearly things that I'm intending to do this thing and I'm doing my best to do it and I did not do it. I failed. And I want to normalize being able to just talk cleanly, you know, not shoot from the hip. That's not the metaphor I'm looking for, but just like be direct around like, yeah, it's a failure and it's okay. We don't want to do it all the time. Like that was maybe a costly one. Like, let's be careful. Like, what's the next step to recover?
What are we
from
learning
this?
From that?
What can we learn from it?
How's that going to serve us? And,
right.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. We're not talking about getting sloppy or like, you know, messy, but having that. And so, you know, related to the project, the learning project, is the project of gathering resources or gathering help. This is also an overlooked time sink if we don't allocate time for it.
Gathering resources.
Gathering resources. And it's related to learning, but you know, the idea that I need to get this thing done, but but I need two other people to do it. And I also need to gather this budget, or I need to gather these resources or these tools, or, you know, or even if it's something as simple as I just need to go get folders and, you know, and labels or whatever.
It's it could still be something work.
It's still work and it takes time. And we don't factor that in to when we're expecting to be productive immediately. And when we do compassionate accountability with our clients, one of the things that we try to name is like, did you not get something done because you hadn't factored in the amount of time it takes to gather the resources so you have what you need in order to get to be productive? And I think that that's, again, it's just like, it's such a compassionate piece to just live in reality.
There are so many applications of this. Like, there's you as a leader, there's how you're leading your team, how you're acknowledging those factors for them. And there's still a fourth kind of work we haven't touched on yet, the communication projects.
Yes. So communicating about the projects. You know, again, I hear people complain about their inbox and complain about their email inbox a lot. And I do my share of that also. And we forget that there is a heart. There is a person on the other end of most of this. Some of them are spam and they, you know, get rid of those. But it's like, you know, there's the reason why it's frustrating is because we're not allocating the time to communicate about what we're doing, about what's happening, about what, you know, it can be part of gathering resources. Sometimes there's some overlap in these different types of work. But the communication aspect of around productivity, underestimating it is where we get into trouble. I guess what I'm wanting to say is that what I typically hear from folks when we name these four types of work, one, we hear relief, which is, you know, of course. But the other thing we hear is like, gosh, if I'm doing all these things, like, when am I getting anything done? And I'm saying that is precisely the point. Mm-hmm. We think that our capacity is so much more than it actually is. To put it another way, projects take up more time and more space and more bandwidth than we're willing to acknowledge. And the challenge with being a leader, whether you're a small business leader, a founder, or whether you're a leader in an organization, people who end up in leadership positions tend to have some sense of visionary something. There's not always, but there's usually some kind of a visionary quality. And the visionary quality means that you can see where you want to go to, right? That visionary quality in our mind doesn't pay attention to how long the road is to get there. It doesn't pay attention to what it takes. It's just like, oh, I can see that thing. Let's get there. And you're in Colorado, you know, you look at the mountains and they can look darn close and they are not, because they are huge. They are a long way away. It would take a lot of walking to get there. When we lived in Portland, Oregon, I remember traveling out to Mount Hood and going, God, aren't we there yet? The mountain's so right there, but it's not. Even relatively small projects, especially for someone that's coming at it from a visionary perspective, they're larger than we think. And when we're trying to get it done we're not properly allocating the bandwidth for these different types of work that need to happen so that the productivity can also happen. And when we're forcing our team, especially if someone is not really listening to the team and the team is trying to work extra hard in order to meet an inhumane deadline, it's like spending money on a credit card. You know, the interest is going to come due. The bill is going to come due. You know, you see it in the burnout in your team. It's the same way with the marketing we were talking about before. You can burn through customers, you can burn through team, you can burn through everything. And that is not how you create a sustainable business.
Absolutely. When we're talking about being human-centered on this topic of these four kinds of work and ensuring that we're integrating all four of these into our thinking, into our planning, into our calendar and priority and project management, into how we're leading our teams and working in a sustainable way. That just this morning, and I did a program a week or two ago for a group of CEOs in Europe, and we were talking about urgency. They wanted more urgency. And one of the principles that I think is so important is not to use urgency. I mean, there are times we need to run faster, that's okay, but not to use urgency as a solution for a broken system, a broken process. And this, what you've just described here, these four types of work, one of the biggest ways that our systems break down is because we've not allocated the time, the resources for these things, and we failed to take it into account. And if we try to use urgency as a solution for that, as you said, we're building up debt we can never pay off.
Exactly.
Burnout and people leaving and all the rest of it is the result.
And I will tell you, urgency is really the enemy of almost everything. And, you know, I will lean back into my former career as a paramedic that 95% of the calls that we went on were not emergencies. We did not have to run lights and sirens. There was plenty of time. But even my paramedic instructor always liked to say, like, no matter how bad the scene is, there's always time to check your own pulse. Like, urgency is the enemy of effectiveness. And when somebody feels urgent, our nervous systems get activated. And that is good for like running away from danger, but it's not good for doing precise, important, creative work. And the more that we can calm our nervous systems, the more that we can remember, you know, it's like one of the questions we like to ask all the time of our clients is love available even here? You know, is it possible that, you know, we can bring care and compassion into this moment, no matter how messy or bad it looks? And we like to say that every act of business can be an act of love. And I think that, you know, I know that love is the ingredient, it's the quality, it's the presence that makes everything worthwhile. And it helps us to bring our best selves. And that, yeah.
That is a beautiful place to wrap up our conversation, Mark. We're talking about heart-centered or human-centered leadership. My goodness, that says it all. Can love be here? And is love possible here in whatever we're doing? What a beautiful way to wrap up for today. There is so much more available. Listener, the book is Heart-Centered Business. Our author and guest today, Mark Silver, and a phenomenal book. Particularly, yes, if you are leading a small business of some kind, this is an incredible, almost, you know, and again, don't want to do this from a fear perspective, but I found it incredibly valuable, and I'm sure you will too. Mark, gosh, we're out of time. I don't know. I would love to just keep going here, but I just so appreciate you being a guest and sharing this wisdom and your experience with us today.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for the space you hold. I it's been a delight being here.
Absolutely. Well, it's been our pleasure. And listener, I encourage you, find that way, find that moment, whatever it is, whether it's the four types of work to integrate, the shift in the perspective on marketing, those five qualities of your heart to cultivate, the vulnerability, the patience, or the two that we touched on, but there's so many more, whatever it is, to find that one moment to bring love to your work and in every moment of what you're doing. And even another little bit of wisdom there from your paramedic supervisor, check your own pulse first. we gotta lead ourselves first before we lead our team. So listener, there you've got many different ways to take action today. So I hope that you will, and to be the leader that you'd want your boss to be. And as we wrap up, ask you, if this has been useful for you, subscribe so you don't miss the next one. And be sure and let others know. And one of the best ways to do that, leave a review. They really do make a difference and help spread the word. get these practical human-centered tools into other people's hands and ears. Thanks again, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.